The following program is produced and furnished in conjunction with Derek Dorch of the Diversa Group, which is entirely responsible for its content.
Welcome to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch. Derek walks you through how to win government jobs, effectively manage your government career, and best utilize government services. Every week on Fed Access, you'll learn about interesting federal agencies, workers, and careers. Fed Access provides you the access you need to succeed in the federal government. And now your host, Derek T. Dorch.
Welcome to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Thank you for stopping by the show. We are always glad to have you. Today, we're going to be talking about this cyber threat. Recently, we've had a number of different things going on, some ransomware attacks that have really impacted parts of the world, a number of attacks that have hit Europe and other places, limited bandwidth of the attack in the United States, but has had an impact on a lot of different computers and really has a number of different people within Homeland Security and other areas within our government, within the U.S. government, very, very concerned about some of these ransomware attacks. The WannaCry or WannaCrypt attack recently has really gotten the attention of a lot of different people about how vulnerable we are in terms of the cyber realm. And so this is not just the first time we've had these situations going on. It seems that these attacks are happening at a more rampant pace. And we want to talk about that today. What are we doing to deal with it? How are we trying to find out what's going on? What's the threat intelligence that we're getting? Who's doing these attacks? Are they state actors? Are they rogue actors? Who are the people who are perpetrating these things? And then what are they trying to get from this? Are they trying to get kind of any kind of intellectual property or intelligence? Or are they trying to get kind of certain things where they can use for criminal purposes, PII, personal information that they can use in order to, cause harm upon individuals with their credit and with their finances and other things of that sort? We're going to be talking about all of that today. We're talking to Alan Liska. He's from a company called Recorded Future. You can find them at recordedfuture.com. RecordedFuture.com. They're a company that does threat intelligence in the cyber realm, but they also have a blog on their website that covers all these different issues. And Alan is a security analyst with the company. Alan, thank you for being on Fed Access.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Hey, Alan, talk to us about first, before I kind of get into the details of this WannaCry, WannaCrypt, and everything else and what just recently happened, a lot of times, just to kind of give people a baseline education about the ransomware and what is ransomware, and then what is the impact, and how does it impact both agencies, organizations, or companies, and how does it impact individuals?
Sure. So there are two basic types of ransomware. The first kind is what we call locker ransomware, and that's ransomware that infects a system, most often mobile phones, and basically somebody downloads an app from an app store that turns out to be a bad app, and it prevents you from gaining access to your system. It doesn't encrypt anything. It just prevents access. The second kind of ransomware, and the kind that we're talking about with the WannaCry and has made the news a lot more often lately, is what we call crypto ransomware. And that is either through an email phishing attack or through a web exploitation of a browser, this executable is downloaded to the victim's machine. It runs and encrypts all the files on their desktop. Not all of the files, most of the files on the desktop, and then requests ransom in the form generally of Bitcoin in order to get the files unencrypted. And ransomware operates indiscriminately. So you really hear about three different types of attacks. You hear what we call hacktivism, and those are people that are motivated by cause. Financial motivation, which is what ransomware falls in, and then espionage, which is generally a government-sponsored attack. So ransomware fits squarely into the financial-motivated attacks, and that's simply trying to get as much money from the victim as possible. And the reason that we're seeing so much success here is that there's this instant gratification for the bad guy. You infect somebody, you get money right away. Or they wipe it and they don't give you anything. But when you get paid right away. Compared to older attacks, say like stealing a bunch of credit card numbers, where it would sometimes take months, even a year, to get fully paid, for all the time you spent working and stealing all those credit cards. Here, you don't have to worry about that anymore. You get the money right away.
You know, with this, how, you know, and you've been monitoring this for quite some time. Have you seen an increase in terms of this ransomware? Have you seen just kind of this being used as more of a tool, like you just said, that a person doesn't really have to maybe necessarily break into somebody's computer? They can, you know, go ahead and get this ransomware into somebody's computer, and then it's really a quicker way to get information. Are we seeing an increase in terms of these kind of attacks?
Absolutely. So by some estimates, ransomware was a $1 billion business last year. And you really have to start thinking about it as a business, because it's not, to use the sort of the common term, it's not some 400-pound guy in his mom's basement. These are groups of bad guys that get together, build out this ransomware, update it repeatedly on a regular software update cycle, are constantly making changes and improving their program. But, you know, in essence, in 2016, we can account for about $1 billion worth of transactions of people paying this ransom. That's a very large number. And because of the success that we're seeing from some of these other groups, we're seeing more and more bad actors adopt ransomware. So ransomware will become one of the many tools in their toolbox. So maybe they'll use, you know, bank stealing Trojans or key loggers or you know, all the other types of malware, but they'll also start throwing ransomware into the mix. So they may steal a bunch of stuff off your machine and then leave ransomware behind as well to get a little bit of extra money from their victims. So, and we continue to see that growth happening, and we see more and more ransomware families being developed as more bad actors decide they want to get into the ransomware business.
You know, when we begin looking at this, and you just kind of really hit upon something, that I look at this as a business. Is this more organized crime? I mean, you know, how we look at certain things in terms of the businesses of crime, right? And we've always had either cartels or mafia or certain criminal organizations. Is this what we should be looking at, that this is criminal organizations who are using the technology right now in order to begin kind of doing this? And then also, too, where are they operating out of, Alan? Are they operating out of, you know, certain areas that really don't have the same kind of cyber criminal laws or certain things of that sort? I mean, what are we seeing?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's very much analogous to organized crime. It's almost mafia-like in terms of the way these guys operate and work. And to answer your second question, one of the things that we're seeing with a lot of the ransomware families is they have built-in protections that won't allow them to execute on machines that have the Russian language pack or the Russian keyboard layout installed. So that tells us that most of these actors are operating within the sphere of Russia. That doesn't mean they're supported by Russia, but that means that they are within the reaches of the Russian government, so they don't want to take a chance on infecting anybody inside of Russia, because nobody wants to go to a Russian prison. I certainly don't. So what we'll see is them operate everywhere in the world but there. And that leads us to believe that they're probably operating, if not within Russia itself, probably within one of the Baltic states or Estonia, places like that. The other thing to think about, going back to the business idea, is there's a concept in ransomware called ransomware as a service that we're really starting to see take off. And ransomware as a service is essentially multi-level marketing for ransomware, the bad guy has his ransomware and he rents it out to other people. So you pay $200, you get access to the ransomware, you can send it out, you don't have to develop yourself. You send out the phishing emails or you send out the web exploitations or however you want to deliver it. You can use somebody else's ransomware and they just take a cut of the ransomware of the money that's bought in and give you 60%. So generally the split is the person who developed the ransomware gets 40%, the person who's renting that ransomware gets 60%. So it's kind of like Tupperware for malware.
Wow. You know, I mean, with this and looking at the scope of how this has happened, I mean, with over 100 countries being impacted, but you just kind of mentioned something really, really critical about they don't want to do the attack in certain countries like Russia or other places like that. Would this lend itself to mean that there may be some state kind of sponsored dynamics with this? Or is it really a matter of that, you know, they just understand, well, we should not attack in these countries? I mean, where, how far is this reaching in terms of maybe certain countries saying we're going to get a part of the game?
Right. We can't say for sure that there's any state-sponsored activity. We haven't seen anything that indicates state-sponsored activity associated with ransomware. There is some suspicion with the latest WannaCry ransomware that it may be tied to North Korea because there's some code reuse, but we haven't seen enough evidence that suggests that, that can confirm that or that we can state that with confidence. So, you know, as of right now, we're operating under the assumption that these are financially motivated attackers and that they're generally mafia-like or corporate crime, not corporate crime, but crime-affiliated actors rather than state-sponsored.
We're talking to Alan Liska. He is a security analyst at a company called Recorded Future. They deal with threat intelligence, and you can find their website at recordedfuture.com. They've got a great blog on their website where they've been talking about not only this problem, but some other problems that we'll discuss very, very soon on Fed Access. But we're really looking at the dynamics of ransomware. We're looking at the cyber attacks. We're looking at threat intelligence. What should we know about what's going on in this cybersphere in terms of understanding where the threat is coming from? It seems as if many people now are very, very concerned about, you know, how to protect their organization, their agency, their company, but also how to protect themselves from, you know, these culprits in which they're putting this ransomware onto your computer and they're basically making demands in order to release your computer. You've got to pay them something. And we want to talk about this and many more of these cyber threats. We'll be right back after this break. You're listening to Fed Access with Derek T. Deutsch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Fed Access with Derek T. Deutsch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. If you're just joining us, we have been talking about cyber. We've been talking about the cyber threat. We've been talking about ransomware. We've been talking about what's going on with these new attacks, the WannaCry, the WannaCrypt, kind of these new ransomwares that are popping up that have impacted over 100 countries, the U.S. included, but not as much in the U.S. as it has been in other countries. We're talking about the impact of this kind of stuff. We're talking about how to protect from it, and we're going to also be talking about some kind of new things that are coming up on the cyber threat realm. You know, we're looking at all of these different issues because it has an impact on all of us, whether it be criminal organizations or state actors. Cyber and cyber attacks is really kind of the new type of warfare that's going on, and also the new type of crime that's going on as well. We're talking to Alan Liska. He's a security analyst at a company called Recorded Future. They do a cyber threat intelligence, and they take a look at all these different things for agencies, organizations, and companies, trying to make sure that they're protected, trying to make sure they have the right intelligence in order to protect themselves from all of these emerging threats. They've got a great blog on their website, which you can find at recordedfuture.com, and just go to the blog. They're trying to keep people abreast of everything that's going on in the cyber realm. You know, Alan, when we look at this WannaCry, WannaCrypt, ransomware, you know, what's been the impact across the world? And then I know me and you were kind of just talking over the break. It doesn't seem to have impacted the United States. Why is that? Not as much, I should say. Why is that?
So there were about, as of last tally, there were about 300,000 infected computers, which is a lot for the short period of time that it was very active. Part of the success that we had in the United States was simply the matter, a bit of luck in terms of geography. So WannaCry first hit in Europe, specifically either Spain or the UK. That gave security professionals in the United States a five-hour head start before people started turning on their computers and potentially getting infected to start putting protections in place, which is always good. But the other part is that in a lot of ways, the United States has invested much more in cybersecurity over the last few years. So that's been a real focus. And while EMEA and Asia Pac are starting to catch up into that area and rapidly catching up, because the United States had a head start, there were fewer vulnerable systems to be hit in the U.S. That doesn't mean there weren't any, because there certainly were companies and individuals that were impacted by this. But there were no reports of any government agencies, U.S. government agencies, that I saw that were impacted by this. And the number of companies that were impacted was limited. A lot of those companies, it's because they have an office over in Europe that got infected that then spread to the rest of the company.
Mm-hmm. You know, with all of this, that also kind of thinks to, you know, to me about a kind of a tactic of maybe some of these criminal organizations. Are they beginning to look around the world, and are they able to tell around the world about what countries maybe have some of the older software that is not being kept up to date? And that a lot of times with that in certain countries, they begin knowing that, especially maybe certain countries that, you know, maybe they have not been as technological advanced, but they're starting to use computers more and more. They're starting to use cell phones more and more, but they may not have the newest kind of upgraded security systems or the defender type systems. Is that part of a tactic that some criminal organizations are beginning to look at?
Absolutely. So that was not the case with WannaCry. With WannaCry, honestly, based on the lack of sophistication of the attack, I think it was just dumb luck. But for the more advanced actors, absolutely. We see a big concentration in areas that have, we specifically see concentration in areas that have lots of bandwidth but low security. So one of the biggest targets we see right now is South Korea, where South Korea has made a big push to increase the bandwidth in the company and provide in the country, excuse me, and provide low cost, high speed internet to everybody. But they haven't kept up from a security perspective, which means that there's a lot of open routers, systems connected directly to the internet, and they are great targets for both exploitation but also redirection. So if I'm launching an attack and I'm sitting in Romania, my IP space might be blocked by companies that I'm trying to target, but the IP address space in South Korea isn't necessarily blocked, so I can infect the system in South Korea and redirect my attacks to my actual target through that system in South Korea.
You know, the reason that kind of draws my attention, of course, is because, you know, South Korea is one of the U.S.'s major allies, right, in terms of when we think about certain things and kind of what we've been dealing with North Korea and a number of different areas. So with all of that, and given the number of maybe U.S. resources and other things that may be in the region and in the country, it still leaves a lot of vulnerability to possibly U.S. and U.S. systems in terms of maybe intellectual property, in terms of maybe some of our military people, in terms of a number of different things that can still really impact us. Is that true?
Absolutely. I mean, you are, when you are in a country, you are just as vulnerable as everybody else in that country. So, you know, that's something to really think about. And in fact, we see more and more of these kind of reports coming out about, when you talk about security of a country, so if you're traveling overseas, you may go to the CIA World Factbook or the State Department to find out what the security posture is. We're starting to see more and more companies add in what the cybersecurity posture is. should I be connecting to the Wi-Fi in a hotel in this country? Or if I do that, am I pretty much going to have my computer infected? You know, those type of things that are a bigger concern, especially right. for government travelers.
You know, when we began looking at that, and something just really caught my attention when you said the lack of sophistication with this WannaCry, WannaCrypt situation. Break that down, Alan. I mean, when you mentioned that, the lack of sophistication, maybe in comparison to other attacks, what are you seeing with that? This was, you know, very simple code, just a very simple process. They got it off the dark web or the deep web, and they just kind of, you know, modified a couple things. What are you saying when you say lack of sophistication?
Absolutely. So what we saw is the exploit itself, or what they call the Eternal Blue exploit, that's part of the Shadow Brokers dump, which the assumption is that is from the NSA, although that has not been confirmed.
Mm-hmm.
That exploit itself and the backdoor that's included with that exploit, which is called Double Pulsar, those are very sophisticated tools. They were bolted on to a very unsophisticated ransomware. So the ransomware itself, the actual WannaCry ransomware, isn't very good at its job, in terms of, it doesn't do very good at being stealthy, so it doesn't hide from antivirus programs the way a more sophisticated ransomware, would. The fact that they were only asking for $300 is suspicious. Most, advanced ransomware attackers based what they're going to charge, what the ransom's going to be, on where the request is coming from. So if I see that you're a home user, I'm going to charge you a little bit of money. But if I see that you are connecting from a major corporation, your ransom just went way up. Hmm. So there was a lot of unsophisticated parts of this tool. They just happened to get really lucky because they're the first that thought about bolting the ransomware onto this the Shadow Brokers exploit. And one of the proofs that we have of that is that right now we've seen about 300,000 people around the world that were infected by this. Less than 2% have actually paid the ransom. That is a very low percentage of infected computers that pay the ransom. We've seen Verizon reported in their latest breach report that something like 48% of small businesses who are successfully infected actually pay the ransom. So a 2% payment rate is actually very, very low. And so over the 4 days now, over the 4 or 5 days now that since the campaign's been active, we've managed to track around $80,000 in ransom payments to the WannaCry actors. Now, admittedly, $80,000 is more money than I've made in the last 4 days.
Right, sure.
Right, but I also didn't infect 300,000 computers.
Right.
So if they had been successful in what they were doing, we would have expected that number to be much closer to $1 million, given the number of infections.
Right. We're talking to Alan Liska, and Alan, I want to come back to that when we go to the next segment, because that's a very, very interesting point of the success, you know, or you know, of course they got to some people, but it wasn't as successful as other ransomware attacks have been. And like you said, it could have been because of the lack of sophistication of the program. We're talking to Alan Liska. He's a security analyst at Recorded Future. You can find their website at recordedfuture.com. They've got some great information on the WannaCry and WannaCrypt ransomware attack, but also other attacks that we're going to get into later on in the show. We've been talking about these cyber attacks, these ransomware attacks, these malware situations in terms of really the impact around the really world, and also the impact on the United States in terms of our businesses, in terms of certain areas of national security and international security, and just also for anybody in terms of your own personal protection. You may be traveling around the world. You know, what is the impact if you go to other countries? Are you safe? Are you secure? Do you have to start thinking about these things before you travel? Sometimes we talk about travel security in terms of a person avoiding terrorism or a person avoiding kidnapping or crime. But now you have to also begin thinking about things on the cyber realm. And we're talking about that today. We're going to be right back after this break. Listen to Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Fed Access with Derek T. Deutsch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. If you're just joining us, we've been talking about cyber. We've been talking about cyber attacks. We've been talking about threat intelligence. Looking definitely at this WannaCry, WannaCrypt situation, this ransomware and the impact on that, but also just the whole realm of cyber and cyber attacks. We all know that this is kind of the new realm of warfare, the new realm of crime, the new realm of a number of different things. And we're talking about how to deal with it and also the impact of these attacks today. We've been talking to Alan Liska. He's a security analyst at a company called Recorded Future. Recorded Future is a cyber threat intelligence firm, and they provide services and products to a number of different agencies, organizations, and companies who are out there working to protect them, working to give them the threat intelligence that will really kind of give them the knowledge to make sure that they don't get impacted by these cyber threats, these emerging threats that are rapidly evolving almost on a daily basis. And we're talking about this today. You know, Alan, you mentioned about the impact of the attack in terms of, you know, them only getting about $80,000. I want to kind of address that in two ways. One, in terms of being able to track how many people are paying. Two, if a number of people got infected, the only reason they didn't get as much money is because the tools are out there to really kind of take this stuff off their computers very, very quickly because of the lack of sophistication? Or is there another reason that they did not get the money that they were looking or that they were looking for based on getting 300,000 computers impacted?
Yeah. So there's no decryptor for the WannaCrypt, at least not yet. There's a couple of security companies that are on the verge of developing it, and again, that lends to its unsophistication. And when I say a decryptor, what I mean is the way the ransomware works is it uses a unique key pair for each infected host, and that key pair allows the attacker to encrypt the files on a system and then store what we call the private key on a server, and when the person pays the ransom, they can give them the private key. So that part of the encryption is actually very, very hard to break. But if the encryption is actually implemented poorly, it can be reverse engineered, and then you can figure out what that private key would be, or you can figure out another way to break it. So that files can be decrypted without having to pay the ransom. And there are a number of ransomware families where that's happened and happened consistently. There are others like Locky and Cerber and some of the more sophisticated ones that still haven't been broken. So in the case of WannaCrypt, there is not a decryptor yet. So the reason probably most of the people haven't paid the ransom is that either the systems that are being infected aren't important systems, or they aren't systems that they need to have files from. They may have, you know, if it's in a medical setting, a healthcare setting, it may serve a certain purpose, and you can just wipe and replace it because there are no files directly on that system. Or it may be somebody's workstation where everything is actually stored either in the cloud or on a file server in the network. And so in that case, the company or the organization may decide, I don't care about your personal pictures or anything else you've stored on your company desktop. We're just going to wipe it in and reinstall the operating system. So, and again, that comes to that unsophistication because it's spreading itself everywhere without giving any kind of consideration to the nature of the system that it's spreading to. The WannaCry is often finding itself just on junk machines that no one's going to bother to pay a ransom for.
That's very, very interesting. And now I definitely understand what you're talking about, kind of the unsophistication, because it's not really having that major impact on people like a lot of other ransomware programs have had. And so, you know, people, and ransomware is very much about somebody opening up that or hitting that link, right? A lot of times they got to hit that link in order to for that software to run, right? Is that right? Oftentimes, and so if it's hitting onto a computer, and either someone is hitting the link or someone's not hitting the link, and even if it's like an old computer, it's like, you know what, I don't really use this computer for anything anyway, then it doesn't really make a difference. I'll just wipe the system clean and then start all over. Let me ask this: Is that the way when a computer is impacted, right, with ransomware, and if they either get some kind of software to take it off, is that computer ever clean, or do you really have to kind of wipe it and start all over again? I mean, once something has been infected, do you ever really are able to clean it off?
I always encourage people to wipe the machine and reinstall the operating system. As I said in the beginning of the interview, ransomware is becoming part of the arsenal of these bad guys. Consider it, to use the Batman analogy, it's just another rung on their utility belt, right?
Right, sure.
They have all these other tools in here, and so we're seeing more, it's happening more frequently that in addition to laying down ransomware, the bad guys will lay down keyloggers, they'll lay down, Trojan stealers, they'll lay down all kinds of other tools aside from the ransomware.
Mm-hmm.
So if you clean the ransomware, you may still be leaving a keylogger, you may still be leaving a program designed to steal your banking credentials behind. There could be all kinds of other things that are there. So when it's infected, it's much better to remove it to make sure that you know everything that's going on, but then wipe and replace in case you miss something.
Wow. And that just kind of was getting to the point that I was kind of getting to, because I'm thinking a smart person or smart criminal or state actor, whatever the case is, would really kind of build a program that would have almost several different pipelines for me to continue to do the attack against you, right? You got this one, but I've got almost several, like you said, a keylogger. I've got maybe something else that's sneaking in the background and doing other things that you didn't catch here. And so you would almost need several different defending or several different kind of programs in order to attack each. It's like almost some kind of disease that has, several different kind of components, and you attack one, but there's another piece to it, right? Is that just becoming more and more common, and it seems to be really, really difficult to defend?
Yes, it's more common, and it is very difficult to defend. And as again, as we talked about, because these are criminal organizations and not just some guy in his mom's basement, they're constantly changing their tactics. So what we've seen is, still the most common way for ransomware to be delivered. That's not the case with WannaCry, but the most common way for ransomware in general to be delivered is through a Microsoft Office document. So you get a Microsoft Office document in the email, you click it, it says, oh, you need to enable macros in order to run this. Well, what the macros are doing is they're reaching out and grabbing the ransomware and installing it. They're not actually doing anything in the document itself. But because it is an Office document, and it's a macro, all of which are legitimate tools, your antivirus and other endpoint security systems don't necessarily catch that. But now that's the most common way for it to be delivered. But now that the endpoint protection tools are starting to catch on to that, we're seeing other types of tactics. So we're seeing some ransomware that never uses an executable. They just simply use API calls to the Windows machine, the underlying Windows system, to install and run the ransomware. So with no executable, again, there's nothing for your antivirus or endpoint protection to flag on. And they keep evolving their tactics as security professionals evolve their tactics in order to detect them.
Wow. I want to, get into this new virus with the Chinese piece, but it really does seem, Alan, that these criminal organizations, because of the nature of it, this is almost as if these guys are getting so much money. And then you kind of mentioned about kind of tracking it down. Is it very, very difficult to kind of track down once this is started? And then once people are paying, is it hard to track these guys down financially and really to kind of get down to the root of I don't know if they're using bitcoins or other places like that, but is it hard to kind of track them down as a law enforcement organization? And is that also because of the nature of the international dynamics? They may be operating in certain countries that really don't have the resources to track them down. Is that true?
Absolutely. So two parts to that. First is, yes, Bitcoin makes it very difficult to track this down. So if you remember, as recently as 2010, 2012, there used to be all these pop-ups that called themselves like, they were browser pop-ups that said, oh, you've been infected by, this antivirus program. You need to spend $40 to download this and we'll fix it, right? That those are what we call fake AV attacks. Sometimes you'd see it as, we detected porn on your computer. You need to pay a fine to the FBI. Send us $40. Things like that were sort of the precursor to ransomware, but they all relied on credit cards. And what happened is eventually all of those organizations were taken down because credit card transactions are traceable. Doesn't matter what country you live in, they have to go through the SWIFT network, and they can eventually, you'll be identified, and that can be stopped, and all the money can be taken away from you. Because the bad guys have moved to Bitcoin, that is much more difficult to track down. Now, it's not impossible. We've seen some really great takedowns over the last year of some of these big organized crime gangs because law enforcement's getting much better at working not only with the financial community, but with the security community, companies like Recorded Future, like Symantec, like McAfee, these security companies who have a lot of truth on the ground because they have the surface data.
Right.
So if you're law enforcement and you come in after the fact, you see the after effects of that attack, but you're all of that, preponderance of evidence is multiplied when you go to somebody like Symantec who's seen this attack 100,000 times. They have much more data. And so by law enforcement working with both the security community, security researchers, and the financial industry, they've gotten better taking these down. Now, yes, if you go into a country that just doesn't have the law enforcement or doesn't care, there's not a whole lot that can be done. But even countries that have limited law enforcement or limited laws on this, they don't want these gangs operating inside of their country in a flagrant fashion. If you want to operate under the radar, they're not going to do anything. But when these gangs start to get too big or too powerful, then there's an incentive for those countries, too, to make sure that they're all arrested and gone to jail.
Right. We're talking to Alan Liska, and he's bringing so many good points. I wish I don't have to stop him. We got to take a quick break. But we're talking about cyber. We're talking about cyber threat. We're talking about cyber crime. Talk about ransomware. Talking about all of these different things that are going on in the cyber realm. How to deal with it. How to get the right threat intelligence in order to kind of prevent your agency, organization, or company from being attacked. How, as a personal person, how to prevent yourself from being attacked. We need to know what's going on. Alan's from Recorded Future. He's a security analyst, and they've got a blog on Recorded Future. Go to recordedfuture.com. There's a blog that really kind of breaks down these attacks and what's going on. We want to talk about China in a few minutes because they have been one of the state actors that have been going on and doing certain things. So when we come back from a break, we're going to kind of move from the criminal organization to some of these state actors and then kind of go from there. You're listening to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. If you're just joining us, we have been having an interesting conversation about what's going on, and engaging in interesting conversation, I should say, about what's going on in the cyber realm. These are things that we all need to know about because, honestly, it has a very, very strong impact on us, our finances, our national security, our intellectual property security. If you have a business, a number of different things can be really, really impacted. Healthcare. Companies should be concerned about this because ransomware has been impacting that in terms of health records, in terms of equipment. There's just a number of different things that's going on in the cyber realm right now that is becoming more of a critical threat all the time, and we're looking at how to deal with it. We're talking to Alan Liska. He's from a company called Recorded Future. He's a security analyst there who's working on analyzing all these threats. They also have a great blog on their website. If you go to recordedfuture.com and hit the blog, you can read about a number of these different things about whether it be the WannaCrypt, the WannaCry, about what we're about to talk about right now about China, but a number of different areas in the cyber and the cyber threat realm. Alan, what's going on with China with this this new situation in terms of looking at I believe it's called AP3, and all the different things that they're going on? What is the Chinese ministry state security doing in terms of this APT-3? What is this, and what are they doing?
So this is one of the many groups within China that's engaged in cyber espionage attacks. One of the challenges is we know there's a lot of Chinese cyber espionage activity that has happened, that has occurred over the last decade or so. But it's very hard to track them down and isolate which group is doing what and who's engaged in what types of activity. And so this is one of the first times that we've been able to specifically link this group, APT-3, to the Chinese Ministry of State Security. And that's really important. Yeah, it's a very interesting and ongoing discussion, and I know it's beyond the scope of what we have time for today. There are two schools of thought in security. The one school of thought is, I don't really care who's doing the attacking. I just need to know that I've got protections in place to do this. And then there's another group that, again, I think more accurately, realizes that understanding who is behind the attack is just as important as the basic indicators of the attack, because actors evolve over time. And so knowing who these APT-3 guys are, knowing their techniques, knowing who they're targeting, means that you can put in better protections in advance of an actual attack from them. So even before being attacked, if you know that they like to use certain tools, that they like to go after certain types of data sets, that they move in certain ways within the network, you can take steps to protect your network if you think you may be a target of them. And that's one of the reasons that we produce the information we have about APT-3. It's to let people know, let as broad an audience know what type of techniques and tactics that these guys are using, what we've seen from them, who they have targeted, and what we expect to happen from them in the future.
And it sounds as if APT-3 is really being used from China as almost an intelligence collection tool. Is that right, Alan?
Right. So they're going out and they're gathering data on a whole lot of other companies. Now, China has a slightly different view of cyber espionage than the United States does. So the United States considers cyber espionage to be, hey, we want to find out what the Chinese government, the Russian government, whatever, what they're doing, what their plans are. We want to know this information. The Chinese government has a broader view of cyber espionage. So they not only want to know what the U.S. government's doing, but they want to know what our major companies are doing. And they often share that information with major companies in China. So they may break into a steel company and then take data from that steel company and deliver it to Chinese-operated, owned steel companies as well. So that's a much broader definition of espionage, and that's the type of intel that APT-3 has been collected, and that's why they are collecting from so many different organizations, not just the U.S. government, but defense intelligence organizations, telecommunications, technology companies, healthcare, and so on. So they've really had a much broader range of targets.
You know, real quick, Alan, how does APT-3 and this kind of programs, how does it infect these companies? How does it kind of get through these systems in order to start grabbing this, collecting that intelligence and grabbing that data?
So one of the really unique things about APT-3 is that they tend to use publicly available tools. So, if you're looking at, if you're looking at a traditional spy organization, they'll develop custom tools in-house that meet certain requirements. But APT-3 really focuses on tools that you can buy on the underground. So if you go onto a Tor site or you go to a dark website, to use that term, you can buy a lot of the tools that APT-3 uses, which makes it much harder to track them down because they're using tools that anybody with $1,500 and the idea of being a bad guy can use. They just have more sophisticated and professional attackers behind those tools, and so they're much more successful. And you talk about, you know, protect, you know, users protecting themselves and so on. One of the things you really have to be careful of is, because they're professional, because this is their job, they go in 9 a.m., leave 5 p.m., just like everybody else, they have the time to really build up connections and find identifications. There's a great article that just came out today in Time magazine about how, switching away from this for a second, how the Russians spent years identifying members of the DoD that had Twitter accounts, and then targeted those members on Twitter with advertisements for things that were associated with stuff that they seemed to like based on their tweets. And that's the difference between one of these financial organizations and a cyber espionage, a country coming after you, is they're not just looking for you at the office. They're looking for you at home. They're looking for you on message boards that you may spend time on. They're looking for you on Facebook. They're looking for you on LinkedIn. You know, all of those places that you would think that you're safe, but you're really not, especially from the Chinese. It's a great example, sort of old school. When I got my first clearance, I remember going to a briefing where the very nice lady who gave the briefing, one of the things that she said to me was, and this is very hard to hear for some people, it's when you go overseas, if you're a 4 in the U.S., you're still a 4 overseas. So if a 10 comes over and talks to you at the bar, expect that it's a foreign agent. And that same thing.
That's very powerful, Alan. That's very powerful for people to hear, right? It doesn't change when you go to another country, right?
Right, exactly. And same thing applies to social media. If a very attractive woman is suddenly trying to be your friend on Facebook, and it's not somebody you know, there's a pretty good chance that especially if you work for the federal government, there's a pretty good chance that it's a foreign agent that is trying to get intel about you. And not just you, but your family. You may do a really great job of locking down your Facebook or your Twitter or your Instagram or whatever so that other people can't find you and reach out to you. But if your kid is posting everything everywhere, they can befriend your kid and then befriend you. So it's, you know, unfortunately, that OPSEC doesn't just apply to you, it applies to those around you as well.
I wish we had more time to talk about this, but I'm going to have you come back, Alan, because it's so much good stuff that you're talking about that needs to be known, especially, you know, those in the national security realm, but just really all over the place. I mean, whether you're working for a company, these organizations are really trying to get a pattern of life on people and really understand them not just at the office, like you said, but just their whole life, because they're targeting them everywhere. And that's some really, really important information that you have just given and a number of good examples. So we're going to definitely have to have you back, because I want to keep this conversation going. I wish we had more time, but I want to thank you for all the insight you have provided. It's Alan Liska. He's from Recorded Future. He's a security analyst, recordedfuture.com. They've got a great blog on there with a lot of different good information. Thank you, Alan.
Hey, no problem. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.